RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Cameras, scissors, pens, torches, and television sets are the objects that form part of our daily life, and we hardly give them a second thought. But all are designed to a lesser or greater degree. My guest today has dedicated his professional career in helping to make the products we use more practical, sensible, and beautiful. There is little that he has not tackled, but his personal favorites are the many products designed for the medical field: incubators, heart monitors, beds, and operating theatre equipment, all to help make life for the patient, nursing staff, and doctors safer, more useful, and pleasant. My guest is Nick Butler, and his personal mantra is making things better through intelligent design, and he has been doing that since the 60s. After graduating from the Royal College of Art, he won an IBM scholarship to the United States, where he worked under the mentorship of Elliot Noyes, the eminent designer and architect. But America was not for him, and he returned to the UK and quickly established a reputation that led him to form BIB Design. And very quickly, it became a premier product design consultancy, winning many awards, including the Queen's Award for Technology and Export Achievement, and for Butler, an OBE for his services to design. Now semi-retired, he shows no sign of losing his passion for design, and most days can be found in his basement workshop where he prototypes his imaginings into reality. I spoke to Nick Butler at his home in Deal on the east coast of Kent.
1963 to 66, you had left Leeds College of Art and arrived at the Royal College of Art to take on the industrial design course, where Misha Black was one of the principals. Just tell me, first of all, this would be 63, so it was a really kind of magical period in terms of design in this country.
Well, design,
where everything was coming together.
Music, all sorts of creative activities.
Were. So who was there at that time? Who were your contemporaries? Peter Blake, would he have been there?
No, he was slightly before me. He was 4 years before me. But there were certainly people like
Hockney
was there.
Yeah, Alan Jones.
And the painting school, and in graphics there would be Dayton was there before me, but
So Ray Hawkey,
Ian, I can't remember his name. The hit me with the old rhythm.
Oh yes, Ian Drury, of course, he was there.
He's there.
Yes.
And all the guys, all the girls, and they're either going out with musicians or whatever. So, the canteen time or refectory time was the Rolling Stones and the Pretty Things. And
this was at a time where I think it was encouraged to actually...
There were no Chinese Wars.
No Chinese Wars, which is...
Well, yeah. Ozzie Clark was a contemporary of my year in the fashion school.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing was everyone used to meet in the common rooms and things. And there was no difference whether you're a fashion designer, a product designer, a graphics designer, an illustrator, a painter. No difference at all. Everyone just, there were no Chinese wars. They weren't cliquey and they weren't cliquish. Everyone related. And in fact, there were a lot of shared projects at that time.
Yeah, that's...
For instance, we had shared projects with ceramics and textiles and graphics and illustration. And in painting and sculpture, we had shared projects. And some of the industrial designers actually changed their course and went to the sculpture school.
And that was
and that was perfectly possible at that time. Yeah, yeah. The college didn't frown on this at all because they saw us as a creative hotbed, I suppose. I thought it was quite tough. I mean, Misha was quite tough in that it's the only place I've ever been to where you had an examination every term. That was his doing. But I think, in a sense, he was quite right. He was sorting out whether people wanted to do it or not, and they could count the mustard.
Was there occasions when people were thrown out?
Yes. Some people never got to the end.
Oh, really?
And for instance, the guy in my year, Martin Ash, who was Sam Spoons in the Bonzo Dog Doodah band, he's a product designer, and he was in... grave danger of being thrown out because he was so busy with Bonzo Dog, you know, engagements and things in his final year. That we all the students, not just in that department, chipped in and helped him through making things for his final degree show.
I suppose they're
his designs, but yeah. I mean,
it's an interesting period because I mean that moment in the 60s, not only at places like the Royal College, but at Oxford and Cambridge with Footlights. Everything was happening, and I guess it's because, you know, prior to that, many of the students at that sort of age would have either been off in the army.
Yes, I missed the army by one year.
Yes, because that's right. You would have been. You would have been at the very end of that.
So and I think my father was terribly disappointed that I hadn't,
bit of disappointment. Done it. Well, I guess that was the big kind of revelation. Suddenly there were all these, bright young things that could really push their energies into new areas. And I think that I've always felt that had a lot to do with it, that no longer are people being plucked and taken away for 2 years, which is fundamentally would change their life. And I've spoken to a lot of other people in these interviews where the army life actually they found it tremendously beneficial, really did. Others hated it. So the Royal College, this very privileged place with all these wonderful people working in an area that you really now fall in love with. So let's just backtrack very quickly.
Passionate about it, actually.
I'm sure. I just want to backtrack very quickly now to where you were born and a little bit about your early life. So just tell me the family that you were born into. Your father was a policeman.
Yes, he was.
You had an older brother who was in the army.
In the army, yes.
And so what was that life like? Was there sort of creativity within the household? Or?
Well, there was creativity in the fact that, in the sense that my mother was a dressmaker, in that she made all of our clothes and things like that, and rugs and everything that the house required, really, the furnishings. And Dad was really quite good with his hands because before my father was born in 1898. It was amazing, really. But his first career was he trained as a carpenter. So he never lost that. And
making is sort of somewhere
very,
in the background.
Very good at making things. And very, anything in wood he could make. And he'd make it perfectly. He'd make it very well. But he liked being a policeman, and he was a proper policeman, the old-fashioned sort. He was always broke, because whatever money he took out of the house that my mother gave him, she had to actually dispense it in allocated sums, because he'd spend it, but what he'd spend it on was giving it away to people who needed a cup of tea or help, or they're running out of money and they couldn't buy food for their kids, or whatever. And he was a great, respected man in this little town that 25,000-30,000 people, but everyone knew him, and if they were in trouble they'd come to him.
And your schooling at that time, what sort of, is it not just local school?
I was a choir scholar to Wakefield at the grammar school.
Okay.
It's a cathedral town.
Yeah.
And I loved music. It was the love of my life, really. I mean, I liked singing, I liked choral works, and my mother played the piano, I forgot to say that. She used to play the piano at home, like a lot of families did then.
Yeah, of course.
And I had to learn the instruments and things. But running parallel with that, side by side, was this fundamental great love of making things and taking things apart and understanding how they worked and trying to improve them, I might add. Not always successfully, but... making a clock strike 13 was great fun. Yeah.
So do you remember, I mean, that time, which would have been in the 50s, the kind of the general enthusiasm centred around the Festival of Britain?
Yes.
And all things...
I went. Yes.
You went?
Yes. School trip.
And did that have an effect on you?
It did. It had a very big effect on me, but I never thought that I would eventually become involved with that sort of thing. But it sort of had the effect on me, it showed me that it was possible to actually become involved with those sorts of things. I didn't know how to do that. And there wasn't much help at school in terms of the advice at school, really, was to go either you went into civil engineering or mechanical engineering or electrical engineering. Yeah. But that wasn't for me the turning point for me was seeing North by Northwest when with Cary Grant and Eve Marie Saint, when he asked her on the train, what did she do? Tell me, my dear, what do you do? And she said she was an industrial designer. And that was it. I thought, girls like that, you know. So I found out about, I thought, what's industrial design? You know, it sounds fascinating. And I found out that Leeds College of Art offered a course, but then you had to do 2 years intermediates. And so I did silversmithing. Yeah, I had to do, if you were doing industrial design, you either did silversmithing or furniture.
Hmm.
And I chose silversmithing. And I still have one or two pieces now that I made. And I loved it. But industrial design is wider.
Yeah.
And I was more interested in the wider issues of design and what you could do and achieve. And also making lots of them.
Yeah.
I mean, whereas silversmithing, one tends to be making a select piece.
Exactly, yes.
Not necessarily true, because you can mass produce in silver, but I was more interested in designing things that lots of people could use. That was always a great motivation for me.
And of course, you know, just thinking back a little bit, just during the war and just after the war, you had this very practical aspect of design that was produced for the masses, that which had what was called the utility mark.
Yes.
And they're also building, yes, at the time, prefabricated buildings. It's rather
nice sign, that utility
mark. It is, yes, yes. But there were a lot of very good, solid pieces of design that were built to last. I think you can still go to junk shops and find them.
Absolutely. But, well, prefabs were only supposed to last for as a temporary solution.
That's right.
But there are still places where they're probably standing. In fact, there's still a place near Abergavenny where there is a little estate with original World War, just after the war prefabs.
Yeah.
And they're still there.
Well, that seemed to me to be the kind of a really good example of design being put together out of a real need and a solution that was really cleverly produced. So many of the people that were bombed out in London that went to live in places like Essex and moved into these places were astounded because they suddenly had fitted kitchens and they had
bathrooms
which are unheard of. You know, it was
inside toilets.
Yes, all of those things. But I mean, that was a kind of holistic approach to a complete building with all of the gadgetry in it, all fitted and designed. So,
it preceded all these huff houses now, you know, where everything's built in, which are marvellous.
That's right.
Examples, but really they're only developments of what the prefab was.
That's right. Well, let's come back again. We'll wind forward back to your Royal College days. So here you are, coming to the end of it now. I think you were there for 3 years, coming to 66 when you're ready to be launched out into the world. So tell me a little bit about those last years and what happened post Royal College.
Well, the last final year of the Royal College, I did a joint project really which set me on my way. I mean, funnily enough, it was an industrialized project, which, you know, we were talking about prefabs earlier, and I did that in collaboration with another student called Peter Isherwood, who became my partner when I set up in business a little while later. He was the I in BIB. And I completed that course, and I never actually saw, we put together the degree show, but I never actually saw the show myself, or in fact collected my degree at the convocation, because I won a scholarship to the States.
The IBM Fellowship.
Yes, and that meant me, because the Royal College always finished later than lots of other places, they needed me in the States.
So did you apply for that fellowship?
I was invited to apply for the fellowship, and I sent in the application, and I never even thought about it, really. It was something I just applied for. Yeah, we had to write to a chap called Rainer Banham, who was an architectural sort of historian type chap. The phone call came through, and Misha, as I got to know him as, because I did a bit of work for him in his office in the vacation periods and things. Sort of said, boy, he said, because he always called people by boy name, taking out his fag from his mouth and tapping off the ash. Boy, he said, you're not going to make the degree show. And I thought I failed, you see. I thought this was his way of telling me that I wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
And I must have been ash in the face. He said, no. He said, you've got an opportunity to go to America, and I advise you to take it. And so that's what I did, in fact. And I went to the States, and first of all, had to go to Elliot Noyes, a famous American designer, was my
mentor. I was going to ask you about Elliot Noyes, because Elliot Noyes, maybe those that are unaware of him, he was very much an architect, but was responsible probably for the world's first, identity program such.
IBM.
And he brought in Paul Rand, who was another famous honorary royal designer. And also, he was responsible for the forecourts of Mobile gas stations. And Ivan Shermayev was brought in to do that. So he had it seemed to me he had a real understanding of what graphic design was at that time.
And industrial design.
And industrial design. And architectural design.
Across the piece.
Yes.
I mean, he was literally, he was, in my eyes, what I'd been at the Royal College for, where I'd gone through a period of 3 years with no Chinese walls, being with creative people the whole time, and then suddenly being put into this
into a box,
into this chap's hands, and he was my mentor when I was in the States. And I arrived in the States, and he took me off to the Aspen Design Conference, which was my introduction to America. I thought, God, is it all like this?
Did you ever get to his Connecticut home?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Which I have seen photographs of, and it looks like so many of those, like the Eames's house, low-level, modernist glass box. It looked beautiful.
Well, he's altogether a terrific experience. And this, of course, only confirmed me in my view. I'd chosen the right sort of course in life.
Really. I think that must have been pretty glamorous at that period.
It was, and that was misleading in a way, because I thought it was all like that, and it isn't, of course. I mean, there's a lot of, I had worked hard at the Royal College, don't get me wrong, but it was rather heady stuff when you just graduated, just suddenly being thrust into that sort of company and meeting all these people and the introductions being affected and gone.
So what were you doing during this fellowship? What was your kind of daily routine?
Well, I had to work for Elliot Noyes.
Yeah.
And
so he had his own practice.
He did, yes. And I was a sort of, I'm sure that Misha had primed him. I worked on one or two little industrial design programs and projects and jobs, mainly for IBM, actually.
Yeah.
It wasn't long before I really decided it wasn't for me, because I didn't really like working for anyone, and I swatted that very quickly.
Is that called the arrogance of youth, or being single-minded?
A bit of both. Yeah. A bit of both, actually. There's quite a lot of arrogance, I think, in it. I find it very difficult to take instruction, especially about design. I'll listen to any pearl of wisdom about lots of other things.
Yeah.
But design, I always believed in my own thing and ability, unless it was to do with something we were working together on as a project. But I was never a very good assistant, a good assistant at all. I wasn't assistant material, really.
No. So how long did you?
I was there nearly a year.
And so so it rolls to an end. This and lovely glamorous life.
And it all ended really nicely, and I left a lot of friends there. But I realised the States wasn't for me, because certainly amongst my age group, it became very clear to me that in the States at that time, that one of the sort of major objectives in life was to become wealthy in the States. God was mammon. The mammon was money. And in any conversation you had socially, the conversation wouldn't be talking for very long before the conversation turned around to how much money did you make, or what's your sex life like, I found this rather extraordinary. I couldn't hack it.
The fact that they were so open.
Yes.
As opposed to the reserved English character.
I just couldn't take it. I was quite unhappy about this side of life. So I decided to come back, and the opportunity was there to stay, but decided to come back.
Now, if I got it right, I think you came back, and for a while you had a spell at the Greater London Council, is that right?
The Great GRC, as it was then, unbeknownst to me while I've been in the States, had employed Peter Isherwood, who had been my joint collaborator on this industrialised building project, and GLC had taken up this industrialised building design with a view to supposedly trying to implement it in the Greater London area, which is great, you know. So I joined that team when I went back, and although it was never built as a housing scheme, it was built as cladding panels for buildings with all of the infrastructure of the panel contained within it, i.e. the plumbing systems, the electric. So nothing's new.
No. So we're back to prefabricated buildings.
Yeah. Nothing's new. And then I had an opportunity to do a little job for a man called Clive Sinclair.
Oh, yes. Made famous for his, computer, I think.
Yes, he did radios first.
Radios, and of course then the C.
Well, I worked on some of those early things, not the later things. But. And so, never having liked working for anyone else, I bit the bullet. And the graphic designer that I knew had a space in his office in Covent Garden.
So this would have been when Covent Garden was Covent Garden.
It was wonderful.
Yes.
It was wonderful. This office was above Rule's restaurant in Maiden Lane, and mm-hmm. it was the top floor. And it was only, to begin with, it was only me, and in terms of the little design office that I had. I used to work all out, because I used to do not only the design work, the concept work, the design work, all the detailed drawings, the model making, all in this little office. You know.
And this would be for Sinclair?
It was Sinclair, and then there was another company called Setpoint. I don't know why. I think I was lucky.
How did you get the work at that time? Were you approached, or did you go out? I mean, you were...
The first project I had was through the introduction that this graphic designer gave me.
Okay.
Because he was the graphic designer for this company. Mm. And he suggested my name, and he's not around anymore, actually. Mark Story, he effected the introduction, and the work just snowballed. I don't know why. And then I worked for a company called Setpoint, and I think that because they couldn't afford to take on a sort of large organisation, and Setpoint were bought out by then Decca, and Decca were looking for an industrial designer, and I pitched for the work along with other quite well-known people. I managed to get the work, and I can remember that the Decca then was, this is the radar navigational company. Mm. They were very military minded because they were all ex-RAF and naval people from the war. And I can remember that Commander Taylor, who was the marketing director of Decca, saying, well, why should we use you, boy? You've no experience. He said, you know, 2 years out of college and you've been in America. And he said, so why should we do it? And I had a brainwave. And I said, because I'm good and I can do the work. But whatever you pay me, but whatever we agree as fees for the first year, I will commute into your shares.
Ah, that's an interesting clause.
And the bloke was absolutely dumbfounded.
That's an interesting thought. I mean, an unusual one. How did you arrive at that?
Well, I had been figuring out for quite a while how I was going to get a chance to get into, you know, to get into companies and make them trust me, really, so to give me the opportunity. And I was lucky when I was at the Royal College because Misha's course included, unusually for that time, business management.
Really? Yeah,
and the person who taught that was DRU's business manager, Dorothy Goslett, who wrote the first book of professional practice for designers. And she became a good friend, well before it became well known. She just became a good friend. She was a very good advisor and mentor, and for some reason I got on well with her. And she'd said, well, you've got to get people to trust you in business, and it's not just a question of what you can do, it's how much you're prepared to trust them.
Yeah.
In terms of it's reciprocal.
Yes.
In terms of the arrangement, and so I had this idea that if the opportunity came up, I would do that, and it worked. The chap was so flawed.
Well, I certainly never heard of that.
And
before.
Then I had to go to the bank because I had a year to do this work, and no income.
And so how did you survive?
Well, I said, would you give me a contract to say that that's what you're going to pay me and this is what we've done, and agreed. And he did. And he said, why do you need... I said, well, I need to go to the bank to tell them that I need some support. And he laughed and he thought it was great. And he wrote me a contract and a personal letter, and I went to the bank in Lloyd's, Covent Garden, just down the road from Rules, where the office was. And when you see this charming man, when bank managers were really nice, Douglas Murray, his name was, and he was completely intrigued and floored. He said, I've never had a proposal like this before. And he funded me.
Well, this is an aside, but it's a similar story. I mean, that's a really interesting... No one has ever told me anything like that before, but a very good friend of mine who's in a string quartet needed to have a loan from his bank manager to buy a new violin. So he took his violin along to the bank manager and played it for him and got the loan. And it's a similar thing to what you're saying here. You're going along with your work and saying, this is what I've done. I'm going to invest into this company, so please support me. It's a great story. Maybe it's something more people should...
Well, they did very well, and I enjoyed the work with Decca. It was very varied work, and Decca then transpired over the range of their companies, radar and navigators and fish finders and certain navigation systems generally. There are 6 or 7 companies within the group, and when I first then started working for them on the first project, Charles Taylor, said, what do you know about radar? I said, well, not a lot. I said, but I can find out. And he said, yes, you're going to find out. He rang up later that afternoon and said, collect your tickets from the reception at Decca House on the embankment. There's a train fare up to Peterhead, where I joined a trawler, and I went to Iceland for 3 weeks on a trawler.
Wow.
And learned about radar and navigation.
And so your job then was I'm interested to know, because, you know, there's a certain aspect of product design which is synonymous with many designers, where you're very much talking about sort of the glamorous end, if you like. And then there's a kind of hardware end, and I see this as being very much the hardware end.
I've always been involved with all aspects, and very early on, because I've been used to working in teams at the Royal College on the industrialised building system. And it's part of Misha's theory, really, that you should be working in terms of collective expertise, because you can't know everything yourself. Decca had a marvellous bunch of electrical engineers, electronic geniuses in some instances, and mechanical engineers. And I worked with each team who was responsible for a certain product. I always had total responsibility of how the product went together. So, for instance, I can give you a really good example. When the first radar system I worked on, which is called a 914 system, which is all to do with the scanner sizes and the wavelengths, the working radar was spread over 3 laboratory benches, which occupied a room which is 2 or 3 times this length.
Mm-hmm.
It worked as a radar system, ending up with a scanner. My job was to put that to make sense of it and put it into a composite package that would fit onto a ship. So I'd work with the people to see what was possible, but the end result would be something that looked like that, and
yes,
was ergonomic, and you could handle the controls and everything else. But there was a lot of discussion and designing to get all those bits on the benches into a form you could actually encapsulate, if you like.
Yes, and in terms of, if you like, the physical design of the shape of those things, I mean, what possibilities did you have? Because I would have thought that a lot of it was almost preordained.
You can't obviously affect the tube, the cathode ray tube, because that's a given.
Yeah.
You couldn't affect the printed circuit board, because that's a given with the transistors and the solid state devices on them. Mm. That's a given.
Mm.
And you had to have control knobs or controls. Mm. That's a given, but you could design your own.
Yeah.
So really the given would be the fixed pieces of hardware, like the cathode ray tube, which is like a television set.
Yep.
There's not much you can do about the screen.
No.
But how that is packaged,
housed,
and how the electronics are housed is very much up to you. It varies enormously depending on what the project was. if it was something like the radar navigation systems or medical equipment, you'd have to work with a team of people who all had different forms of expertise, and you'd be the one who pulled it together to get it into that particular form.
Mm.
If it's a product like a range of torches, like you did for Duracell, Durabin torch, their brief was, how do we sell more batteries? I mean, the responsibility for all of that would have come from BIB, from...
I mean, I think that, you know, the Durabin torch is a good story, because I remember those, the black and yellow little flip-up torches, and they were, that still sell, and they're very beautifully made. And that seems to me to be more of a classic product designer's product, as it were. I am kind of more interested, in a way, in, because of all the product designers that I've met, you seem to have gone into areas which maybe others wouldn't necessarily go into. For example, you know, the operating theatre area, which I
a very
I
good example,
fascinating.
But it's really a cause of this passionate belief all my life and interest in how things work and how things go together. And I think once you understand that, or try to come to grips with that, you can radically affect how things look and how they perform. For instance, the very first project I worked on in medical equipment, because by this time I've been appointed to work for British Oxygen Company, who do all the medical equipment in the Western world, just about, with the media in the States and Airco. And the first project was an anaesthetic machine for operating theatre, which is the means by which the anaesthetist delivers gas to you, or drugs to you, or the CO2 absorber, or the vaporizers, or the flow meters, or whatever. Now, the very first, they were built like bits of Meccano, with these things, like bits of scaffolding, really. And anaesthetists were very much a law unto themselves in terms of how the machine went together. So there was no rationale. So machines were terribly expensive. You couldn't get any synergy between, sort of commonality between the units at all. And so by going around a lot of hospitals and seeing how these anaesthetists use these machines, the machines were called boiled tables. And the very first question was, like a child asks how, why are they called boiled tables and not anaesthetic machines? And that's because a man called Dr. Boyle was the first anaesthetist to put all these bits together in 1903, would you believe? And so my next question was, well, that's great, but in the Western world, and I literally mean the Western world, why do all anaesthetists operate the machine left-handed? They said, good question, don't know, why? And I'd found out from the research that Dr. Boyle was left-handed. And since 1903, every anaesthetic machine that was made was built as a left-handed machine. So every student going into medical school had to learn how to use the machine in a left-handed manner. So I said, wouldn't it be nice, wouldn't it be good, if I designed a modular machine that was capable of being constructed for a left-handed user or a right-handed user? That was the first step. Mm-hmm. So that takes you in the direction of fundamentally affecting how the structure of a design works. So then, apart from designing the individual bits like the flow meters and the vaporizers and the CO2 absorbers, you're actually basically reconfiguring a whole product in a different way. Now, this only happens by design. It doesn't happen by any sort of being a clever engineer or anything. I think you've got to be a creative designer to actually, like the child, ask how, why. Why is it like that?
Yes. So kind of probing and investigating research is the kind of key to making things better. Certainly Absolutely. In that case it is. And tell me, with something like that, with an anaesthetist, did you observe them at work to see?
I spent many hours, not days. I spent 2 weeks in the Mayo Clinic in America, and in California in many hospitals, and in Germany and France and Italy, with SACAB in Italy, and in the UK, watching people, how they did things.
Yes.
And then thinking, well, why are they doing it like that? not just with an anaesthetic machine, but with something like incubators, children's incubators, which is one of the projects that I did.
Yeah.
The incubator really was based on the fact that, you know, the original incubator had been made out of an oil drum. I said, come on, you know, things have moved on a little bit. But it's because it actually evolved that way. And people, after a certain time, they get used to things being like they are.
Yeah.
And they don't question, this could be different. And when you ask the surgeons and the anaesthetists and the operating theatre staff why things are like they are, and they say, well, because this is medical stuff, you know. Nothing to do with arty-farty sort of designers. And
sure.
We know. And I say, well, fine. Why then, when you come out of the operating theatre, you scrub up, you take off your gown, you've got your nice cashmere jacket on and your Armani trousers, and you go outside and you climb into your Porsche or your Mercedes or your Beetle, and you go home and you probably have Corbusier chairs and, you know, and you prepare to work in sort of lousy condition where life is involved.
Of course, yeah. So you kind of, I guess, made a little mark for yourself in this area.
Well, it's an area that I designed lots and lots of things in my life, but the medical equipment, because it isn't stuff that is sold in the shop.
Yeah.
And it doesn't receive exposure in the high street.
No.
People are not really aware of it. But I don't mind. In fact, I quite like that. But it's the area which has probably given me the biggest buzz in terms of fundamentally affecting things. And even to this day, although it's at least 12, 15 years since I designed the last piece of medical equipment, all of the operating theatres in the Western world are based upon my designs. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because I had a knee replacement a couple of years ago, and I went into the Radcliffe in Oxford because I knew the people then, because I know lots of people. And he's an anaesthetist I'd never met before, and in the pre-operating thing, he said, "You're Nick." He said, "Tipu, the surgeon," said, told him who I was. And he says, "You're Nick Butler, who designed all this." He said, "You must feel very confident." And I said, "Quite the reverse."
Oh, well, that's rather nice to think that you. Where you fundamentally change a product for the better and to make life easier for anaesthetists who no longer have to use their left hand.
And
right
the surgeons, hands. The monitoring.
And yes. And did you also do, I think you did a bed as well, one of these?
Yes, the beds. I've done several beds and lots of monitoring machines, cardiac monitors and fetal Doppler monitors, children's monitors. Many, many medical products.
Well, let's move away from then. I want to talk a little bit now about BIB.
Mm-hmm.
So there you were in Covent Garden, you were doing various freelance work. So tell me how BIB came about.
Well, it came about because I became so... Decca work, it really started to ramp up very quickly. It was quite obvious that I needed help. And I'd always... It had always been the intention when it got to a certain stage that Peter Isherwood would leave the GLC and this project, which is our joint project anyway, and come and join in the design practice. So Peter joined and then it initially became Butler Isherwood Design Associate, and it stayed that way for 3-4 years, and we'd known Stephen Bartlett at the Royal College. Stephen was a designer that I admired immensely, and through a series of meetings and discussions, Stephen came on board very rapidly. And so the original BIB was formed within 3 years of, 4 years of starting freelancing. And we had a very happy sort of period of time. Peter left fairly quickly. Because I think he's more interested in sort of the academic world than the design practice. But Stephen Bartlett and I were in practice until 15 years ago, 20 years. We were in practice for, I mean, BIB was in practice for, stopped.
You started in 69, so
yeah.
You probably stopped, what, 3-4 years ago?
I stopped when I was 60.
Yeah,
so seven years ago. BIB stopped 7 years ago. and Stephen left 12 years before that, 10 years before that. Because, again, not because of any dispute in the practice or anything like that, but Stephen was passionate about painting. And because it had been almost like it was originally at the Royal College, where you could actually do different things and want to do different things.
How big did the practice get? That it's kind of high.
It got to about 22 people.
Yeah.
Sometimes a bit more than that, but the core was about 22 people.
And running the business, that side of it, how did it divide up the responsibility? Because normally in...
Initially, Peter Isherwood was handling the business as it started to expand, but then we brought in a business manager,
mm-hmm.
and we've had a series of business managers throughout the life of the practice.
And I think towards the end, did you not move the practice out to the mill house that you...
Yes, well, from Maiden Lane, we ran Marvellous Rules, where we used to get marvellous hot beef sandwiches late at night, so while the market was slow. We moved to, we've always been quite seeing an opportunity. I heard of a company that was going bankrupt just off Berkeley Square on Bruton Place. It was this advertising company. And I bought out their debts. And with that came the lease of this studio on Bruton Place, which happened coincidentally to be on the same floor as Rodney Kinsman and AMK, and Brian Morrison of Lupus Music, who was a pop entrepreneur. And so we had, that was a great time we had there. And then I heard of a chapel we were there in Bruton Place for 4 or 5 years. And then I heard of a chapel church being for sale in Holland Park,
mm-hmm.
Clarendon Cross, near Julie's restaurant. And
is it always near restaurants for you?
Absolutely, food is a great motivator. Yeah, I love. Well, it is for any designer, I think, because apart from creatively cooking and enjoying that process, food is important because you work such unacceptable hours.
Yes, I mean that's an interesting point because I think design is I've always felt. And not in terms of hardship, but design is a 24-hour business because it's always on your mind.
Well, I think we all, as is witnessed by a lot of designers I know, have paid incredible personal prices at some points in our lives, either with our families or with our marriages or whatever, because it's...
But do you think that's because fundamentally it's a creative activity, and as a creative activity it becomes an all-consuming passion?
It's obsessive.
And other things get pushed out of the way because of the focus.
If you're working on a problem,
you
can exclude almost everything until you've actually got to the point of resolving that problem.
Yeah.
And it becomes a passion almost. Mm. I mean, it really, really does.
Yeah.
And even now, when I'm still working individually and I've gone back to the maker designer sort of things, I still have some clients that I work for, but I make the prototypes myself here. If I get into my workshops downstairs, and I'll show you later, and I'm working on a problem, that's it. I've got to be dragged out.
But that, I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, the rewarding sides of being a designer, because it is. I mean, I've always felt as a graphic designer, different era to you, but the same kind of compelling passion, that it's the thing that's actually carried me through all sorts of difficulties.
Absolutely. He will carry you through, even illness, he'll carry you through, even when you don't feel very good at all. Mm. I mean, it'll carry you through the whole thing. Because your work, and I always say when if I'm asked a question when I'm giving a talk anywhere, I'm really, really lucky, because my work is my hobby.
Mm.
It's my passion. I mean, I don't even have to find a hobby, things to do, because if I'm not doing anything, I find myself doodling about something and thinking, well, that's quite good, that's quite a good idea.
Yeah.
I've got book after book after book after book of all sort of little ideas.
I think that that's, that we're all very fortunate as designers to being given that kind of gift, because, you know, waking up in the morning, for me, is always a real treat, because it's exciting.
it's like going to school, you see. You learn something new each day,
yeah.
And you can never know enough.
Exactly, I agree.
Never know enough.
I think when you meet those people that are, you know, most the designers that I'm always suspicious of are the ones that are very mouthy and think they know it all. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we don't know it all and we'll never know it all until we're, you know, long gone, because there's always something new to learn.
I like to think of designers as almost as a child in a sense. Don't get me wrong, but childish. But it's just this incredible innocence of continually being able to ask the question, why? Why should it be so? Why is it why can't it be different? For instance, I can see no reason at all why we have to design scissors for a left-handed person or for an old person, or jar openers for a left-handed person or an old person. We should be designing a good-looking, attractive, beautiful product that's lovely to use and that for everyone.
Yes, I mean, I seem to remember in, I think, somewhere like Beak Street, the left-handed shop, yeah, where you bought
left-handed. Well, it goes back to my anesthetic machine. I mean, why? Yeah. A lot of design is about education, you know, or educating people in terms of not to have a better sense of design, because that's a terribly difficult thing to do. But education is, this left-handed machine only happened because the man was left-handed. But the biggest problem was not designing the product. He was actually going to the medical school and telling them to stop teaching people to use something in that way. And that, you get an entrenched opinion then, you're up against.
But if I remember rightly, the Arga cooker was designed by somebody that had various, I think it had a disability, and that the cooker, aspects of that cooker were designed specifically because of his situation.
I think that's true, yes. I can't remember the name of the person now. It's a long time ago.
Long time ago, yeah. Very, very old. Is there anything that you've always wanted to design that you've never been able to or had the opportunity to?
I don't think that would ever stop. You mean a specific product?
Yeah, I mean, is there, you know, an area of products that you haven't really sort of...
Well...
Because I know you've, I mean, looking at the list of things you've done, you seem to have covered most things, electronics and
your radar zones,
pens, watches, television sets, cameras. In fact,
JCB.
Your Milolta camera was Euro Camera of the Year in 1985. So, and of course, Ferguson TVs and so forth. So you've done pretty much a big range of things, but I just wonder, you know, whether there's something.
Well, the boy in me, I was partly, it's partly satisfied when I worked for JCB and worked on designing the Sidemaster earth moving equipment. But the boy in me, I'd really like to, because I collect tin toys, I would really like to design one of these huge, big machines with huge tires.
Oh, yes. The ones they use on motorways.
Absolutely.
Yes, they are fantastic, aren't they?
I can find interest in all sorts of things in terms of the type of product. So there's no one thing. I love boats. That's the other thing.
Well, you now live by the sea.
Yeah.
Just a few miles up the road, you have Dover, and with masses of radar equipment sort of...
Yes,
mostly
still based upon...
Your designs, and you've got a telescope so you can view it. I just wanted your view on something. I mean, we live in an age now where the word design is sort of being woven into everything, and the latest is, I mean, apart from all of the old cliches, you know, designer drugs, designer babies and all that, we're now being told that designer thinking is the new thing. You've got to think like a designer, and that seems to be a little mantra that's coming up in various management schools and so forth. And I just wondered what you thought about that sort of view that's being sort of spouted quite a lot.
Not a lot, really, in the sense that I don't think everyone can think like a designer. I think that's just a fundamental fact. As everyone can't be a musician or a poet or a writer, every field of creativity is slightly different. Of course, you can be interested in it and appreciate it. But to try and think like a designer, I don't think it's within everyone's compass. I just don't think it's possible. So they can say that, but they won't be able to do it. They can think creatively, because I think everyone is creative.
Yes, I think creative and... I mean, I've noticed that the word designer thinking is being now spouted about a lot.
I think, well, designer is a very much abused term. I mean, not going to the thing about drugs and clothes and things like that, but it's almost when people can't find the right word to describe something which is slightly out of the ordinary or creative, they say designer or design.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very much bastardized word, you know. I mean, because I'm really proud to be a designer and what I do, but everyone thinks they're a designer. If they in your world, if they have a computer, they're a graphic designer.
Yeah.
I mean, they're off they go.
Absolutely.
It's going to do it for me, isn't it?
Well, I mean, talking of that, I mean, obviously the computer itself had a fundamental effect on everything. I mean, you know, buildings that were just an impossible dream now can be built simply because
the computer... they can be built, but I would also urge caution, saying, are they the right thing to build? Because if you can draw it with a computer, it doesn't necessarily make it right. There are lots of examples of buildings around where every individual component, the architect will tell you quite proudly, is bespoke, it's different. Well, I'd like to know what's clever about that.
Just tell me one thing before we wrap this up. You left BIB at around the age 60, I think.
Yes.
Was that a kind of calculated thing?
It was several reasons, yes. I didn't totally retire at 60, but I think that it really was to do with the fact that I had a serious illness. And I thought, well, if I get out of this one, you know, we always say that to ourselves. If I get out of this box, not literally, but out of this constrained area, I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to do my bit in giving back things back to people that I think a lot about personally, rather than being quite so selfish as I have been as a designer.
But you now that you're living by, you're in the idyllic situation, you live by the sea, we can see it from here, from your window. You've got a workshop and you still have a few clients just to...
Yes.
Keep your hand in. And...
Well, I suppose I work 3-4 day week still, but in a different sort of way.
Yeah.
BIB was very pressurised and it was big business, really. I mean, when you... One of the things that didn't get to me, but you know, you didn't really have to turn over a substantial sum of money a month to pay everyone and everyone's mortgages and look after everyone. And
now that's an interesting point, because I've been through a similar thing, and I wonder how much that has an effect on... Well, I know from my point of view it has an effect, but when you get to a certain scale, so you have 20 or 30 people and an overhead to go with that, that's quite a major, major worry, can be, particularly through different economic sort of climates. And it's an added factor to the normal event of a designer. Designers really, in my experience, really just want to do what they love, which is design, but you've got all these other things clinging to your back. Did you find that a draining... I mean, I knew you had a business manager, but
towards
you have
the
to share.
Towards the last, I can say quite honestly, the last 7 years, I found it very exhausting because I was doing less and less hands-on designing.
Yeah.
I was still designing, but I certainly wasn't designing all the time at all, and being more concerned with running the business, looking after people socially in terms of their needs and emotions and everything else. You find that the buck stops with you in terms of everything. So people will come to you with their problems, and I didn't mind that, but it did become rather dominating in terms of... I felt it got in... It was getting to me in terms of the loading of it. And so when I became ill, because I was giving a talk somewhere and I suddenly lost my voice. I suddenly found I had cancer of the throat and all that goes with that. Fortunately, I still got my voice now. I thought, well, I'm going to change my life.
Yes.
But in terms of working, I work on some projects. I also have great pleasure in doing the thing that you can't do if you're running a large practice, in saying, well, I've had a great idea for something. And in the practice, you couldn't sort of follow it up and develop it, unless the client say you were doing something for royalties or something like that. But if you had a great idea, you couldn't develop it and find a manufacturer and say, look, I had a great idea, and stitch together a group of people, if you know someone in marketing or someone in finance or whatever, and stitch together a group and say, well, let's do this. There's a project here. And I've had great fun down here, because I've done it now I'm working on the fifth one. I'll show you tomorrow. Having an idea, because of knowing all the people you've known throughout your career, saying, well, Henry Smith or whatever it is down the road can make that. This person who is just up their street in marketing terms. This person is just up their street in terms of the retail end of the equation. Or this one is just up their street in finance. You stitch together a consortium and everyone works on the project for a percentage of the action.
Mm.
And the result is that you get everyone committed to a new idea and a product. And as I say, I'm working on my fifth at the moment.
One last question. For anyone listening to this that's going to go into this world of industrial design, product design, what would you say in this now the 21st century, the reason for design is? What is it fundamentally supposed to be doing?
What is supposed to be? There are lots of answers to that question, but design is, I think, what I've always thought it to be, is something that's providing people with objects and surroundings which are going to fundamentally improve their life and make their life more comfortable and easy and satisfactory and happy. That's what design should be, mm-hmm. in terms of not a selfish indulgence in terms of just designing something for oneself.
Mm.
It should be something which helps society. We've all heard people banging on about society. He says, oh, it's a new concept. But designers have always been concerned about society and the people who live in it and designing for them and helping them live their lives comfortably and well and happily. And that's not going to change for designers.
And in fact, design could also be nothing more than beautiful, in my view, as well. Because that
it
too
can be something which is just heart-stoppingly good. When you look at it and you think, good God, you know, that's really beautiful.
Yeah. Well, on that note, Nick Butler, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.